The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So for the last few weeks, I've been talking about the Noble Eightfold Path. And tonight, I'm at the topic of right mindfulness. So just to have a little context for any of you who may not have been here. The Eightfold Path is the basically the training or the qualities that we cultivate, the path that we walk in order to train our minds and hearts to open to the truth of things as they are. And the Eightfold Path is sometimes given in a framework that the Buddha called the gradual training, so that the Eightfold Path can be seen as a gradual cultivation, a gradual movement in a direction of a training in ethical conduct, followed by a training in cultivating the mind, cultivating our minds, followed by the wisdom that results from these trainings. So the sila aspect, the ethical aspect, sila being the Pali term for ethics, consists of the factors of the Eightfold Path called wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood. And the mental cultivation aspect of the Eightfold Path consists of the three qualities or factors of wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. And so yet last time I talked about wise effort and talked about how actually these three aspects of the Eightfold Path, wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration, can't really be separated from each other. They really work together to cultivate our minds and hearts, to open our minds and hearts, to really meet experience as it is. So last week in talking about wise effort, I mentioned in particular that the aspects of wise effort, there's four aspects, four main aspects of wise effort that have to do with cultivating wholesome qualities and abandoning unwholesome qualities. And that when we're cultivating mindfulness, when we are bringing mindfulness to our experience, when we are recognizing what's happening to us with this mindful attention, that all of those aspects of wise effort are simultaneously cultivated. That as we bring our attention to something challenging, for instance, if we bring our attention to anger, bring mindfulness to the experience of anger, that while we're paying attention to that anger, we are simultaneously letting go of the mindfulness supports a letting go of the quality of anger, and that we're no longer quite so engaged with it. It prevents, in a way, the escalation of that anger to getting worse. It supports the cultivation of beautiful qualities of mind at the same time. It supports the cultivation of mindfulness, of concentration, of the release of anger. So it simultaneously, the practice of mindfulness cultivates skillful qualities of mind and abandons unskillful qualities of mind. Where skillful qualities of mind are those qualities of mind that lead us away from suffering, lead us away from being caught in our habits and patterns that tend to make us frustrated, angry, irritated, annoyed. And the practice of mindfulness supports the letting go of unskillful actions of mind, which are those qualities and states of mind that tend to lead us towards suffering. So states of mind that are rooted in greed, aversion, and delusion tend to be those states of mind that take us towards suffering over and over again. So the cultivation of mindfulness really cultivates all four of these aspects of wise effort, as I talked about last week. And also, one thing I also mentioned last week is this quality of mindfulness itself, which is mostly what I'm going to be talking about this evening, the training in right mindfulness. The quality of mindfulness itself, one of my teachers said, is the most wholesome mind state. So the act of cultivating mindfulness is, in fact, cultivating that wholesome quality of mind. And that's one of the aspects of wise effort, to cultivate skillful qualities of mind that lead us away from suffering. So there's this, kind of embedded in mindfulness itself, if we are really being mindful in the way that we are not reacting to our experience, we're just meeting experience and not reacting to it. That quality of mindfulness has the capacity to support the letting go of unskillful qualities. When we turn our mindful attention to anger, for instance, when we turn our mindful attention to greed or aversion, when we turn our attention to states of mind that are rooted in that, the mindfulness tends to create the conditions for those qualities to appear less frequently. So when we direct our attention, when we turn our attention to difficult states of mind, the mindfulness tends to, like, almost make them evaporate. It's as if they shrink from a clarity of light that the mindfulness brings. And so at the same time, if we turn our mindful attention to beautiful qualities of mind rooted in non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, if we turn mindfulness to states of generosity, of kindness, of happiness, of calm, of tranquility, of peace, it creates the conditions for those states of mind to appear more frequently. So this quality of mindfulness is very powerful. It's got this, like, almost magical quality to it that we don't have to do much. If we're just mindful, the mind moves in the direction of the wholesome and moves away from the unwholesome almost automatically, just by the very nature of mindfulness itself. So a working definition for mindfulness might be something along the lines of being aware of what's happening while it's happening. So the being aware part, that's pretty obvious in terms of being mindful. The while it's happening aspect of that definition is pretty important, because a kind of awareness happens pretty much all the time. There's a kind of awareness that's going on all the time, whether or not we are mindful. So there's a difference between awareness in this kind of just way that we're navigating through the world and doing things. And this quality of knowing what's happening while it's happening. I'm sure many of you have been in a situation where you've been doing something, engaged in doing something, pretty much, you know, fully absorbed in reading a book or working on the computer or something like that. And perhaps something happens around you. Somebody comes into the room and does something. And you're kind of aware in the periphery of it. And if somebody asked you later on, did so-and-so come by, you could probably tell them, yes, that person came by. But you weren't necessarily kind of consciously aware at the moment when that person came by. So that's not what I mean by mindfulness. The mindfulness is really the clear recognition of what's happening in the moment. The kind of meeting, the connecting with experience in the moment. So this quality of mindfulness moves us in the direction of what might be called bare attention. It moves us in the direction of really just being with experience as it presents itself, kind of stripped of filters, of views, of ideas, of opinions about the experience. This quality of mindfulness, the quality, the mental quality of mindfulness, it's something that the mind does kind of naturally. It's not an obscure or unordinary state of mind. We use it all the time. You know, that the quality of mindfulness is this quality of the mind to know or to reflect what's happening in the present moment. And so that quality of mindfulness, of reflecting, if you just think about the way a mirror works, just think about a mirror reflecting. It's not, the mirror doesn't reflect differently depending on what it reflects. The mirror is unchanged by what is in front of it. It just simply reflects what's there. So there's no... It reflects something beautiful as well as it reflects something ugly. The reflecting power of the mirror is not changed by what it is reflecting. And likewise with mindfulness, the capacity of our minds to know what's happening while it's happening is simply a reflecting capacity of mind, to just know this is what's happening. That quality of mindfulness isn't impacted, doesn't care whether what is being experienced is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. The quality of mindfulness, the capacity of the mind to know what's happening in the present moment is just simply that. It's just this capacity to recognize what's happening. There are other parts of the mind that take on the role of reacting to what is happening. The mindfulness itself is just reflecting. So it almost inherently brings along with it a kind of a non-judgmental quality. If we are really connecting to the quality of mindfulness itself, that quality of the mind, the capacity of the mind to simply know what's happening, inherently has a kind of a non-judgmental aspect to it. It doesn't care what is happening. Its job is simply to reflect what is happening. So bringing our attention, bringing our mindfulness, bringing mindfulness into our experience, moving us in the direction of what we might call bare attention, is this beginning to connect with this quality of reflecting, this quality that the mind has to just notice just what's happening without judgment, without reaction, without opinion, without belief. mindfulness doesn't actually interfere with what's happening. Again, it just simply recognizes it. It's kind of this, it's a capacity of the mind to simply notice whatever it is without either repressing it and pushing it aside or indulging in it. So again, something like anger. Our typical response with something like anger is either to try to get rid of it, to repress it, or to act it out. And the capacity of the mind to be mindful and bringing mindfulness to it is kind of a middle way between those two. It allows the experience of the anger, so it doesn't repress it. But nor is it inclined to do anything with it. It simply observes it. So without repressing and without acting on. This is what the capacity of the mind is, to be mindful. The usual way we are in our day-to-day lives is not this way. It's not with this non-reactive, just observing kind of experience. Typically what happens is that there is a moment when we meet some kind of experience. There's a moment where we recognize something that's happening in the moment. So there's a moment of that kind of bare experience that kind of happens to us throughout the day, just a moment of recognizing that. But we don't stay with it for very long. We don't notice it as something to be noticed. What we notice is the thing that we've noticed. And then what do we do with that? All kinds of ideas come up in our mind. What do I need to do about that? How does it relate to me? We think about it, and we decide whether we need to take some kind of action on it. So, for example, we might notice a black spot on the wall and walking up to it, see that it's a spider, and immediately take some action to remove the spider, to take the spider out of the house. So we have that moment of recognizing something that's happening while it's happening. We're clearly, you know, connecting with the fact that we're seeing a spider on the wall. But we're not taking in the fact that mindfulness has come in. Oh, there's this, the mind has recognized a spider. No, we're responding to the spider. We're doing something about the spider. So we've lost that quality of bare attention. So generally, the way we use this capacity of our mind to notice what's happening in the present moment is to respond to the things that we notice. We use that capacity to further our interests, to make decisions, to make choices, to essentially further our own personal agenda. We rarely notice until we come into this teaching and find out that it's interesting or helpful to notice this quality of registering experience. We don't typically notice that bare meeting of experience. Now, I'm not saying here, then what I'm not saying, this is often a confusion that happens with the teaching around mindfulness, which is just this capacity of our minds to simply recognize what's going on. I'm not saying that we should just be zombies and not take action. But what I am pointing to is that moment when we recognize something happening in the present moment, to realize that something pretty amazing has happened, actually. This capacity, this self-reflective capacity of the mind, is an amazing quality of the mind. The Buddha really pointed to, highlighted this quality of the mind, and said this quality is really worth paying attention to. And we don't typically pay attention to it. As I said, we notice the things that we become aware of and then do things with them. But we don't often recognize this quality of mindfulness itself. I think this was really one of the most brilliant things that the Buddha did, was to point to this quality and say, you know, this ordinary quality that happens to us all the time, pay attention to that. Notice that quality. It is a very wholesome quality, and it will lead you towards happiness if you cultivate that quality. So this experience, our normal experience of our lives of responding to things in the world, that normal kind of reactive mechanism is really responsible for a lot of why we suffer. That when we meet something pleasant in the world, we like it, we want it. If we get it, we worry that we might lose it. If we don't get it, we get frustrated. There's something unpleasant in the world, we don't like it, we want to get rid of it. We're frustrated if we can't get rid of it. The feeling of aversion itself is so unpleasant that we're trying to manipulate and control our experience to arrange our world to just see if we can get rid of the unpleasant and have the pleasant, just kind of stack our lives up this way. And that kind of reactive process of the way we live our lives, there's something pleasant, grab it, something unpleasant, get rid of it. That way of living our lives tends to perpetuate that cycle. And we end up kind of like a hamster in a hamster wheel, just kind of spinning, trying to control our environment to create things the way we think they should be, as opposed to just meeting things as they are. So mindfulness is a very amazing capacity that, as I said, is very ordinary. And it's well within our reach of recognizing it, beginning to cultivate this quality. Because it's not some esoteric experience. It's something that happens to us all the time. So one of my teachers is frequently heard saying, mindfulness alone is not enough. That you need to join mindfulness with wisdom. And essentially this is the recognition again of wisdom being the recognition of what is skillful and what is unskillful. Now you can imagine, for instance, a burglar, someone who is sneaking around a house to take things, being very mindful of their activities, trying to be very careful in their movements and knowing exactly what they're doing. And that is not mindfulness imbued with wisdom. So the Buddha suggested that we use wise attention. And this wise attention is related to this understanding that we talked about with right effort of looking at what is skillful and what is unskillful, of recognizing, of understanding. The mindfulness is used to actually understand what is skillful in terms of leading us away from suffering. What is unskillful, that is, what are those things that tend to link us back into the cycle of suffering? So there's really two key elements to wise attention, and that is an aspect of being willing to understand suffering as opposed to immediately trying to fix it and change it and get rid of it. And that's a kind of a shift in our normal way of meeting experience. So bringing in that understanding that it's helpful to, can we just meet suffering rather than trying to fix it or change it? The other key aspect to this wise attention is beginning to explore how cause and effect happen in our experience. So what is the cause and effect relationship to what is happening? How does suffering come into being? How does it end? It's not a random accident in our lives that we're suffering, and it's not a random accident in our lives when we are free of suffering. There are causes and conditions that come into play that create these events in our lives. So in terms of this wise attention, you know, if you think about, okay, I need to bring wisdom into my mindfulness, that sounds like a kind of a, it might sound like a kind of a heavy thing or a big thing. Well, what is the wisdom I need to learn in order to be mindful correctly? And in my experience, actually, the wisdom of the Buddha is so rich. It's like really, really rich chocolate. You know, you don't need much of it. Just a tiny little bit will have a very deep impact. So, for instance, in the early days of my practice, I had read a book that I didn't understand very much from the book, but what I did pull out of this book, it was a book by Joko Beck on mindfulness. And the main piece that I pulled out of that book was, see if you can simply observe your emotions rather than acting on them. And so that is really this teaching of look at suffering. See if you can understand your suffering. Just see if you can meet it without responding. So it's really a kind of a statement of the First Noble Truth. But I didn't understand it in terms of the First Noble Truth. I just knew that I was experiencing a lot of anger, and here was a suggestion, well, see if you can look at your anger instead of reacting to it or thinking about it. See if you can disengage from the thoughts around it and just observe the anger. And engaging in that, just with that little bit of wisdom, was hugely impactful for my ability to navigate my life around this anger. Originally, it was making me just almost completely non-functional, that I would kind of get hooked into that anger and spin out of control, and I'd find myself just kind of frozen, not able to do much of anything. And then I would remember, oh, that's right, I said I was going to notice this, not react to it. At that point, it's like, what do I do with this? You know, I didn't have a lot of training, but I did just simply try to recognize it. Okay, well, yeah, this is anger. About all I could do was say, yep, this is anger, and boy, does this feel bad. And after a few minutes of it, it's like, well, what do I do? Well, I guess I go back to work. And in retrospect, actually, looking at that, thinking about that, that just being with that anger gave me enough space that I could go back to work, that I was no longer frozen and unable to respond. And over the course of weeks of applying this little tiny bit of wisdom with mindfulness, just observing the anger as it appeared, there was more and more space around the anger, and less was I caught in it so deeply. So the wisdom, we don't have to have a massive amount of wisdom here in order to really gain a lot from this practice of mindfulness. But we do need to have this basic understanding of, see if you can meet your suffering rather than trying to fix it or change it. See if you can notice how it happens. So the classical definition of right mindfulness has to do with the mindfulness that's associated with what are called the four foundations of mindfulness, a teaching that the Buddha gave on how to pay attention to our experience. It was one of the main meditation instructions offered by the Buddha, this teaching on the four foundations of mindfulness. There's another translation for that term. The Satipatthana is the name of the training, which typically is translated as foundations of mindfulness. But Thanissaro Bhikkhu, who will be here next week, offers a different perspective on that translation, and I particularly like the way he looks at this. He calls this the training in the four frames of reference. So this is a way of seeing this teaching as sort of different windows into our experience. That these four foundations of mindfulness, these four frames of reference, they cover all of our experience, but that the Buddha is suggesting that we kind of look at our experience through specific frames, through specific frameworks. So these four frameworks or four frames of reference are the body, just noticing what's going on in the physical body. They are the second one is noticing the feeling of our experience, not the emotional quality, but a more basic, fundamental kind of feeling, the recognition of whether experience is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. The third is the frame of reference of looking at our experience through the state of our mind, whether we're experiencing anger or concentration, mindfulness or dullness. Just recognizing in a very simple way, what's the state of the mind? So we've covered the body, what's happening in the body, and two different aspects of the mind, the feeling quality of the mind, that quality of whether something's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral is understood to be a mental experience, not a physical one. And then this quality of understanding sort of the state of our mind, how we are essentially viewing experience, like what color lens are we looking through? What color lens does our mind have on such that we're seeing our experience through that lens? The fourth is a little harder to describe, but basically the way I like to see it is that it's exploring experience through the perspective of some of the teachings of the Buddha, exploring our experience through some of the ways that the Buddha saw as helpful ways to organize, categorize our experience, and in particular, noticing the cause and effect relationship of those aspects of experience. So I'll just go through each of these just briefly. We don't really have time for an in-depth exploration of this. And I'll just talk a little bit about each one. So mindfulness of the body. This one is, there's a lot to this in the Satipatthana Sutta, in the instructions that the Buddha gave on paying attention to the body. Mindfulness of the body. He focused on this. He gave a lot of instructions about how to do this. He didn't just stick with one way and say, this is how you do it. He gave a lot of different tools, for paying attention to the body. And I think part of that is because people are different, and there's different modes that work for different people. But briefly, you know, he started with the breath. He suggested, start with paying attention to the breath. That's a really good place to begin. You know, just connect to the body through the breathing. That's always going on. It's in the present moment. You can always connect mindfully with the breathing. And he didn't limit awareness of the body to simply sitting meditation. In fact, I just read an article that pointed out that the only instruction within the entirety of the Satipatthana Sutta, within the entirety of the Buddha's instructions on mindfulness, the only one which indicates you should do it in a sitting meditation posture is this first one around mindfulness of breathing. The rest of them are not necessarily connected to sitting meditation. They do not have to be connected with sitting meditation. So in the very framework of the way the Buddha talked about mindfulness, he's encouraging us to be aware all the time of what's happening. That this isn't just something to cultivate while in sitting meditation. So in fact, in the body, there's several explorations of different aspects of daily life. He talks about paying attention to posture, and he talks about paying attention to daily activities. He brings in going and coming, bending and stretching the limbs, urinating and defecating. He brings in drinking and eating, talking and being quiet. Everything can be a place to cultivate this recognition of what's happening in the body. One of the benefits that I find in terms of exploring the body when we begin to really turn our attention to the body, we begin to really understand what the body is and what the mind is. Because they're so tightly connected that it's sometimes we confuse. It seems like it's hard to believe that we confuse mind and body, but we do. That, for instance, most people, when they think about their hand, have some kind of an image in their mind about what their hand looks like. And when you feel your hand right now, feel your hand, what does that have to do with the image or what you think about as the shape of your hand? So the exploration of the body, and in particular when we come into one of the explorations, the Buddha talks about the connecting with the elemental experience of the body. As we connect to the elemental nature of our experience, just the raw sensations that this body experiences, vibration, tingling, pressure, pulsing, heat, coolness, lightness, heaviness. That's the physicality of what's going on in the body. And we start to recognize that there's overlays on that that are mental. So the idea of hand, for instance, the concept of hand is an overlay on the experience. When we experience sound, when we are sitting here in meditation and we hear a motorcycle go by, there's the sound. And then there's the idea or the recognition, maybe in an image, of a motorcycle. We might see a particular motorcycle, or we might say the word motorcycle in our minds. Again, this is a distinction between mind and body. And then there's the whole realm of reactivity, that we experience things in our body, pleasant things, unpleasant things, and we react to them. We cut ourselves with a knife. There's just the pain. There's just pain in the body. But then on top of that, almost immediately, there is reactivity. Why did I do that? I should have been paying better attention to where that knife was and where my hand was. Anger at ourselves, frustration, and the whole kind of tensing and contracting around the painful experience itself. There's a huge conflation between physical and mental experience, and coming into the elemental nature of experience begins to tease that apart. We start to recognize through the paying attention of the body what is body and what is mind. And that's a huge starting point. It's really helpful to begin to explore that in your meditation, to begin to clarify for yourself what is the physical and what is the mental. That actually, just that simple dichotomy can be a very interesting exploration when you're in sitting meditation. Just recognizing that the identification of a sound is mental, and that the sound itself is just the vibration, the pitch, the tone. It's pretty neutral. The leaf blowers, the people talking outside, it's just sound. There's reactivity to that sound, which is mental. So starting with the body, we begin to really clarify that for ourselves, clarify the difference between mind and body. And then the Buddha suggests moving into exploring the mind. The first place he suggests attention in the mental realm is to this quality, this exploration around whether something's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And this is a really helpful exploration because it is from this pleasant, unpleasant, neutral aspect of our experience that we tend to leap off into reactivity. So we experience something, we cut our hand with a knife. It's not the cut itself that we're reacting to. It's not the knife going through the hand that we're reacting to. It's the physical unpleasantness that we're reacting to. So that unpleasant quality, pleasant quality, that's where we get hooked. When things are pleasant, we like them, we want them. Unpleasant, we don't like them, we don't want them. So this exploration around feeling is one of the most important in terms of beginning to understand this process of reactivity. It gives us a foothold in seeing how this process unfolds. So it's the beginning of the exploration, in fact, of the cause and effect relationships. Because when we turn our attention to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, we will start to see how we almost automatically will go towards pleasant and away from unpleasant. So we start to see that kind of cause and effect relationship as we explore the mindfulness of feeling. Now again, looking at these as frames of reference, pretty much everything we experience, we could be looking through this lens of the body, that whatever we're doing, there is bodily experience. So we can kind of turn our attention and explore our experience through that frame of reference. Likewise with feeling, every single moment of experience has some feeling to it. It's not just occasionally that this feeling crops up. It happens every single moment. So we can use this also as a frame of reference. We can simply explore pleasant's happening, unpleasant's happening, neutral's happening, really pleasant is happening, really unpleasant is happening. There's kind of a gradation along the lines of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. You know, there's strong unpleasant sensation, sort of mild unpleasant sensation, strong pleasant sensation. So every experience has this quality of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. So we can look at our experience through that frame of reference. Then there's the third, the mindfulness of mind states. And this one is actually pretty simple. In the way the Buddha described it, it was pretty simple. He said, we need to just notice the quality of the mind. Notice whether aversion is present or absent. Notice whether desire is present or absent. Whether delusion is present or absent. Whether distraction is present or absent. Whether concentration is present or absent. It's really simple noticing. You're just noticing presence and absence. It's not saying, notice aversion is present and then do something about it. It's saying, notice aversion is present, notice if aversion is absent. So it's really highlighting that non-reactive, non-judgmental, non-interfering aspect of mindfulness in this area of the teaching. He has 8 or 9 simple categories in this section of the sutta. The ones I've mentioned, plus some more refined types of concentration. So this, it might seem kind of odd to think about that as a frame of reference. Can all of our experience fit into presence or absence of aversion, presence or absence of greed, presence or absence of delusion? Yes. Everything that we experience is within those 6 categories. And then he's got other refinements from there. So I think, you know, this simplification is a pointer to us. You know, we tend to, and you know, when we teach about mindfulness of mind states, we often talk about noticing anger, aversion, irritation, frustration, annoyance, kind of all the subtleties of the emotions. And I have to say that's extremely helpful. I have found that to be extremely helpful. But in this exploration, I think the Buddha is pointing us to simplifying. I think he's pointing us to a really simple relationship with our mind states and saying, you know, just keep it simple as a way to essentially avoid the trap of being caught in the content of our mental experience. Can we just simply recognize, oh, this is aversion. This is not aversion. It can be really, really simple. The fourth is mindfulness of our experience through this perspective of the teachings of the Buddha. Again, especially with respect to this cause and effect relationship. So there's several categories in this one, and I don't really have time to go through the whole thing, but I'm going to kind of highlight 2 that he talks about. So he talks about being mindful of the hindrances and being mindful of the factors of awakening. So the hindrances are various states of obstructions to our concentration. Sense desire, hatred, sleepiness, restlessness, and doubt. And the instructions are basically, again, noticing their presence and absence, but beyond that, to really start to take in what is it that leads to the creation of this hindrance? What are the causes that lead to the creation of that hindrance? What are the factors that, when released, lead to the cessation, the abandonment of that hindrance? So he's suggesting, with respect to these hindrances and factors of enlightenment, that we pay attention to how they come into being, how they fall apart. With the factors of enlightenment, these are factors of mindfulness, investigation, energy, rapture, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. Beautiful states of mind that are cultivated as we engage in the practice of mindfulness. To recognize what supports their arising and what supports their continuing. So again, we're not trying to construct experience. This is really about looking at what is already happening in our experience with these two categories. Pretty much, again, all of our experience can be seen through these two frames of reference, hindrances or the enlightenment factors. Either the hindrances are present or absent, the enlightenment factors are present or absent in any moment of experience. And we're not trying to change or construct experience, but just recognize what is happening. And in fact, the additional instruction towards looking at the causes and conditions, how do things come into being, how do things fall apart? When we mindfully observe a hindrance, as I kind of said earlier, this kind of magical quality of mindfulness, when we observe a hindrance and understand the things that put it together, the mindfulness will automatically begin to release those conditions. When we see the qualities that support these enlightenment factors, the qualities of concentration or equanimity, as the mind understands the factors that come, that create, that lead to the creation of those factors, it's like it's the natural course of things that it will head in that direction. It's just the way the mind is set up. We don't really have to do anything. It's kind of amazing to me that our mind is kind of set up this way. You know, that essentially this movement towards pleasant and away from unpleasant is the typical way that we respond to it, that, you know, we try to hold on to things that are pleasant and push away things that are unpleasant. It's a kind of a twist or a perversion on a very natural process in our mind, that when it understands what actually causes suffering and what actually leads to happiness, and that this kind of happiness that we think we're getting by trying to construct things in the world the way we want them is a really not a very satisfying form of happiness, because the constructing that we do in the world is bound to fall apart. So there's a misunderstanding that we have about what happiness actually is. And when the mind begins to, through mindfulness, understand that what we thought of as happiness isn't really happiness, the mind begins to orient towards something that is more deeply happiness, which is the letting go of these things that cause us suffering, the letting go of the clinging, of the craving. It naturally orients in that direction as it sees, as the mind sees its own contribution to the suffering it experiences, it naturally lets that go. As it sees that as it brings attention to experience, it naturally moves us towards these beautiful qualities, these enlightenment factors, it just heads there. So we do actually do a lot of work to recognize this quality of mindfulness. But we can be a little more allowing of the process in a way. Because the process itself, when we understand that suffering is our lens through which we're looking at experience with mindfulness, those two pieces together will just head us in the right direction. We don't really have to move ourselves in that direction. It really just unfolds kind of naturally. So, we've got a couple of minutes if there's any comments or questions or thoughts, explorations. Yeah, over here.
Hi, my name is Ray. I just wanted to let most people know, I'm sure many here saw it last night, but on KQED last night, Channel 9 at 8 o'clock, was a wonderful two-hour presentation. I didn't see the whole thing, but on the life of the Buddha. Fortunately, here in the Bay Area, we get KTEH, KQED, and a few KCSM and a few others. So it'll probably be on television again.
Uh-huh.
It did present some questions, but I think it's probably a little late in the evening now to go into that. But I guess we could circle back sometime. Maybe it's because I'm new to Buddhism or something, but or the training or whatever. But I was intrigued by some of the miracles. And the one that really jumped out at me was the one where an enraged bull elephant was coming through a village and everybody was fleeing for their lives. This was a mastodon amongst bulls. I mean, this guy was the, he was the Otis Sistrunk of big bulls. And he was really coming. And everybody fled, and there was the Buddha sitting somewhat like this man or this woman here, or like the statue itself or you. And according to the narrator, in this case Richard Gere, according to the narrator, the story goes that as the bull finally got towards, and he's just charging towards the Buddha, as he finally got there, there was so much kindness emanating from the Buddha, this aura of kindness, that the great bull, mastodon elephant, literally kneeled on its front legs, and the Buddha just petted his great leathery trunk. But it was a wonderful program. Coming from the Western tradition as I do, Christianity, it was very enlightening. But anyway, there's much food for thought. So at some point, maybe we can look at miracles.
I don't know that I can really provide an explanation of that. But I mean, we could explore some of those questions at some point. Yeah.
Very well done.
Yeah.
And by the way, it also featured the Dalai Lama, who was always. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
I have a comment.
Uh-huh.
I discovered this place after I've been very intrigued with Stephen Batchelor, and went to see him at Spirit Rock, and saw him again here. And I've been reading his book, Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist. And I really like what he says about studying the historical Buddha, rather than layering things on top of it to promote a practice or to promote a movement. I'm just curious what the position of the center is here regarding someone like Stephen Batchelor.
I don't know that we have a position, as you say. Yeah, I mean, we invite him here to speak. We definitely, like to have a variety of views presented here. Yeah, people definitely appreciate what he has to say. And I, in fact, the Monday night after he spoke, I kind of gave a synopsis and an exploration on what he had to say, because there were some people who were confused by what he said. So I put a little more context around some of what he had to say as well. So that's another, if you're interested, that is on the internet, you can explore that as well.
By the way, I must say that I come from Tibetan Buddhism for about 10 years. And after taking tantric blessings, I realized that I was back in the Catholic Church. And I found myself very, very disoriented because of the requirements of practice. I have some Jewish friends who call Catholics tradition smells and bells. And I think that's sometimes what other practices do too. And surely to titillate the senses, but also it represents a kind of ceremonial practice that I'm not sure I particularly.
Yeah, I mean, I think the practice that we teach here is pretty stripped. It's pretty basic. I keep also trying to come back to what the Buddha said. The Theravada tradition has a huge commentarial tradition on top of it, but I like to be really clear on what comes from commentary versus what comes from the sources, which are somewhat, I mean, we don't even know whether everything that's in the kind of basic teachings of the Buddha, if all of that was at the time of the Buddha or if some of it has been added later, but it's at least closer to what he had to say. And that's pretty radical. You know, it's pretty radical. It's pretty different than anything else that was out there at the time.
You know, one of the things that, I'm sorry, I should stop, but one of the things that Batchelor says in his book, he's comparing, he says that not only does Buddha compare to Muhammad and to Jesus, but he also compares to Aristotle and to Plato. Uh-huh. And I think that's a very interesting dimension that you don't hear mentioned very much.
Yeah, he brought in this aspect of inquiry, and it's something else that I find very interesting. I was just noticing in one teaching the other day that there's a story of these group of people who were having a discussion on the Dharma, and none of them were enlightened. None of them were fully enlightened. One of them had some level of understanding. And he was talking about a particular aspect of the teachings. And during that conversation, that was a back-and-forth conversation, a back-and-forth discussion, everybody became enlightened. So it's not just meditation that the Buddha taught. It's kind of a meditative inquiry as well, you know, that in this exploration of our experience, if we can engage with this inquiry in the Dharma talks, in the question and answer, in a way that's deeply looking into what's happening in our mind and body, there's a lot that can happen. I have hope someday of getting enlightened in one of my own talks. And now we need to stop. So, thank you.